Good morning. And it is a rainy Monday instead of a nice and sunny Monday that I was promised. But that happens sometimes. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, and we have with us again Roger, and we're doing our agency overview of the Senior and Disabled Services Division. So I apologize for being late, which is kind of unusual for me, but I'm here.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Roger Auerbach, Administrator of Senior and Disabled Services Division. With me is Dan Kaplan, Deputy Administrator of Senior and Disabled Services Division, and George Naughton from the Department of Administrative Services. We were discussing the long-term care program, and very specifically, we were at the point when we left off on Thursday talking about measures on page 5-22. And forward, but Mr. Kaplan has a number of replacement pages for you with requests that the committee has made, and I'd like to turn it over to him to walk through the replacements with you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dan Kaplan, Deputy Administrator of Senior and Disabled Services. I have several packages of pages, and I'll just call your attention to them. The first actually came through in a blue folder, and this was done to meet the request that members made to identify the amount of money by percentage that's being spent in each of the sub-programs in our Senior and Disabled Services presentation book. I won't go through them with you, but there are replacement pages for, in essence, what is the first page of each of the program sections. The second package is one that had a blank front like this, and it's a series of clipped pages. If you open it up, what you'll see is we've put together a comparison that Senator Shields asked for last Thursday. In this, and this is something that we used to do in the past, and the Senator remembered it from past years, we would put on one page the percentage and the number of clients served in each of the different long-term care settings, and then on the opposite page, the percentage of the dollars in the long-term care budget attributed to each of those settings. And as Senator Shields mentioned on Thursday, from years back, he remembered that the nursing facility piece of the dollars is very large compared to the percentage of clients, and that the opposite was true of in-home clients and dollars. And as you can see from looking at what we've labeled page 12A and then page 513, that is still the case. Senator Shields, thank you. Roger pointed out to me that in addition to the percentages and the dollars, we've also put in a breakout of the other cases, which appears sort of on the upper left side of the pie. And at the lower right side of the pie, there's a breakout of either how many dollars or how many clients fall into each of these groups. We have also done the same thing for the current biennium, and this comparison is based on the governor's recommended budget that was presented last session. And this was something else Senator Shields had asked for. The next replacement page that we are giving you is a replacement for page 523 and 524, which I will begin talking about when we get back to the presentation book. And what happened here actually is that we found an arithmetic mistake in the 95-97 data, and that's been corrected in this sheet. And then last, I passed out a one-page, double-sided piece of paper with no holes in it on the Oregon Adult Daycare Program. And this is information that you asked for also last Thursday. Created a great deal of confusion.
I'm going to hold the stress, I hear you. We know what is the direction and why I want to take it. Is it a week or something?
95, 97 figures are different on the charts. 95, 97. Everything else is about the same machine.
You can see they're being very diligent about getting their notebooks right. And all that.
Hey, Ron, you have good ears. I can hear my question all the way over here.
You got big ears.
just nosy.
He has good ears.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, are we all set?
Yep.
No, that's all right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Do we know the reason for replacement? Do they make it gold or do they make it so we know what is the reason for the change or the replacement? Can I go over there, please?
Did you understand the question?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Yee, as I've been passing these out, I have been explaining the reasons that we have replaced them. The first group of replacements, which are all the pie charts in the blue folders, are replacements that put in the percentages of the SDSD total funds budget that's attributable to each of the sub-programs. This was a request that members of the committee made on the first day of the hearing. The second package, which compares, also presents pie charts, compares the percentage of dollars within the long-term care program attributable to each of the different service elements on one side, and on the other side, the percentage of clients in each of the different service elements. And this was a request that Senator Shields had made on Thursday. In addition, it presents the same information for the current biennium as first represented in the governor's recommended budget. That was also requested by Senator Shields. And finally, on those sheets, we break out what we call in the pie chart the other cases. We break them out on one of the pages in terms of the dollars attributable to them, and in the other page, the clients attributable to them. I also presented a replacement page for pages 523 and 524, and as Senator Duncan was pointing out a moment ago, there was an arithmetic mistake that we caught in the 1995-97 data, and we have fixed it in this replacement page. And then finally, I gave you a one-page, two-sided handout on adult daycare, which sought to answer some of the questions that were asked about adult daycare on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Another question, Madam Chair. So on 13-7, you added the dollar amount. Is that what you did?
13-37 are two pages to go, and 36 are in the appendix. We had not had either of those pages before, but they answer a request for information that Senator Shields made on Thursday, and they are comparable to the pages 512A and 513, which do pertain to the upcoming biennium. And he asked for the historical comparison.
Good news. You added the dollar amount. Is that what you did?
13-37, yes, adds the dollars for what the governor put into the budget for 1999-01.
Mm-hmm. So you can add a dollar sign to it so that we know it's dollars or not population.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I can draw your attention to page 523, I'd like to talk about several of SESD's performance measures that pertain to the long-term care program. A note on performance measures, we have placed within this presentation book agency-wide or division-wide performance measures, but we've grouped them by program. So over the next few minutes, I will talk about the long-term care performance measures, and then there will be subsequent performance measures in subsequent sections of the book. And as, I guess as a final note on that, when we get to talking about the implementation of the JLAC recommendations, which we'll get to at the end of the presentation, we will talk about performance measures broken out by districts within our system, so AAA districts and SDSD districts, and that'll provide comparative data on the performance of different groups. On page 523, we present information on the percentage of total long-term care Medicaid long-term care clients served at home as a percentage of total long-term care clients. And this is a measure that we've had for many years. It goes back to our first set of divisional performance measures in 1991. And it reflects a value of our system, that we build a system that more and more can serve Medicaid long-term care clients in their own homes. And as you see by looking at the measures over time, the system has certainly progressed in that way. And that, you know, that's partly our work at developing an infrastructure that can support in-home clients, and it is also certainly the desire of most of our clients, if they can remain in their own homes, to be there. On page 524, we have a second measure, and the way we used to phrase the goal was failing a client's ability to stay at home, the goal to be able to serve them in a community-based setting. I don't know that we use that language that much anymore, but this chart on page 524 tracks the percentage of clients in the Medicaid long-term care system served in community-based settings. And by community-based, we mean in-home and adult foster care, residential care, assisted living, specialized living placement. So really everything but nursing facilities.
Representative Schrader.
I assume that the word projected then means target. I guess that the difference between performance measures, you know, outcomes, and just measuring and estimating what the historical trends are. In other words, the question I would, if I'm a legislator next session, assume that your goal is to make the at-home percentage of care at 48.5%. And the reason and the money that allocated to the department would get us to that point, and that has a positive benefit.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, that's correct.
Okay.
When we get to page 524, when we get to 525, we are looking at the percentage of Oregonians. Now, these are not SDSD clients, these are all Oregonians over the age of 65 who are not living in nursing facilities. And this performance measure is in here because this is a benchmark. And the Progress Board tracks this on a regular basis. So as you can see in our state, the percentage of Oregonians over the age of 65 who are not in nursing facilities is increasing. And that's, you know, that's a measure of the ability of our state to care for seniors and especially highly disabled seniors in non-institutional settings.
Madam Chair,
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. This one doesn't have a projection on it, and the going back to the one on 524. I guess my question is looking at it. Is this the governor's revised budget with this projection? Because it seems to me that if you are to reduce Project Independence and reduce levels 15, 16, 17 and do some of the other things that the budget talks about doing. And right now we're only returning half of Project Independence. How can you project that you're going to have more people served in the community?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, actually this is the governor's budget, not the governor's revised budget. So when we next come before you, if you would like, we can have revised sheets that take into account restoration of levels 15 through 17. And
Madam Chair, I'm wondering the assumptions that went into your projected numbers, I guess, to say that you're going to have this large an increase. And is that a good assumption or a bad assumption? I mean, 78.9% in community-based care as opposed to, what, nursing homes?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, it means that we are anticipating in the governor's budget that 78.9% of the SDSD caseload will be in the community-based settings and not in nursing facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, when we revise these charts to take into account the governor's revised budget, that number should go up.
Answer just one more follow-up. I guess the governor's budget also includes those reductions to the community-based care facilities. And I'm just trying to understand how all of that plays out, because it seems like the reductions fall across the board in terms of what the governor was talking about.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the governor's budget does contain a reduction to community-based care facility rates, especially assisted living facility rates, and I will certainly talk about those when we get to reductions, which I anticipate will be very soon. It does not necessarily call for a reduction in community-based care clients, and it's very possible that we'll get some shifting of clients among community-based care facility types as a result of the governor's recommended budget. But the budget itself does not call for the elimination of services to those clients.
I'm going to ask the question in a little different way. And I'm on 524, and your targeted percentage is 78.9%. And it's based on your projections, based on the governor's budget. And that was prior to the governor revising his budget. If with the revisions, what would that 78.9% become?
Well, now I'm going to have to promise you a new piece of paper fairly soon. I don't have that number.
Because I think that's where Representative Carlson is trying to go. These figures are predicated on a previous budget, and so she's asking what would happen if the governor's proposed budget took place, and that would be not only in the it would be in both page 5-23 and 2-4.
Well, and Madam Chair, I guess there's some implications too that even in the governor's revised budget, there are some pieces that aren't restored that I think will have impacts about where people will make their choices or not have a choice in terms of being able to go. And I'm trying to figure out the assumptions that go into, if the goal is to have more people in community-based care and yet the budget is pushing people in various directions that maybe they don't want to go, I'm trying to understand the assumptions that are used in getting to these numbers.
And which then takes to 5-25, and I know that these are benchmarks that are done by the Oregon Progress Board, but and they're not projected, but I would think I would like to know what the target then would be of the percentage of Oregonians not living in nursing home facilities age 65 and older, because these prior figures all had a correlation with community-based activity.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we'll work on those numbers and more replacement pages. If I can call your attention to page 526 and 527, what we've done here is we've compiled data on the Medicaid home and community-based care waiver clients as a percentage of all Medicaid long-term care clients, and we've done this for all the states in the union. The data source is a publication by ARP, known as Across the States. They do this every year, so this is the most recent year's data that we have. And as you can see, Oregon is the state of all that serves the highest percentage of its clients in community-based settings, followed by our neighbor to the north, and then our neighbor to the far north. But after that, there's a fairly substantial fall-off. And the reason that this is the case in Oregon and to a lesser extent in Washington is that really we were the first of the states to make very extensive use of Medicaid waivers, and I think we have been the most aggressive in our use of Medicaid waivers of all the states. And as a result, and I think we spoke about this a little bit last week in connection with issues around nursing facility capacity. As a result, we are dealing with issues in the long-term care system that other states will be dealing with in a few years, but aren't really yet. So we are we here have both the honor and the difficulty of being the leader. If I can call your attention to page 528, we provide a this has long been a performance measure of ours, and it is difficult to explain. So bear with me for a moment. What this chart does is it takes the yearly Medicaid long-term care expenditures from total funds, and it divides them by the number of people in the state over the age of 65. And it is a rough measure of several things, but one is efficiency in caring for an elderly and disabled population. And as you can see from the numbers on this chart, there is really a very wide diversity in the amount spent per person over the age of 65. New York is the highest spending state at roughly $5,100 a year, and Oregon is the 33rd from the top and spends about $1,500 a year, with Idaho just below us. So obviously we haven't given you the full array of states, but at a group across the way. The differences occur for a number of reasons. Firstly, different states have different service eligibility criteria. The notion of being eligible for long-term care in the Medicaid program is not something that's defined except on a financial level by the Healthcare Financing Administration. It's really defined on the state level. And different states have adopted different attitudes. In Oregon, we have long held that it makes sense to be able to provide services to people who are relatively early in the process of losing physical functionality. And the reason we believe that makes sense is that by providing supportive services early on, it's helpful. It's possible to help people maintain their functionality longer. And that's always been our theory. And I think that it's borne out in the fact that we have relatively low overall costs. But there are other reasons that that different states have different costs. Different rate setting systems is certainly a big factor. New York and Connecticut tend to pay very high for nursing facility care. We are not by any means the most generous state, although we're not the least generous either. There are also demographic differences in the states, with some states having a relatively high percentage of folks over the age of 65 in the oldest age categories that is most likely to be consuming long-term care, and other states having relatively low percentages. In Idaho, for example, which has nursing facility rates that I think are slightly higher than ours, actually has a very low percentage of its senior population in the oldest old category. And I think that helps keep their dollars down low.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Chair. Sure.
Oregon has long pressed to have home-based
outpatient, no, I guess not outpatient, non-extended care facility programs, and it's been a leader in that. And I'm trying to sift from this if it's, I mean, obviously on a humane basis, it's a better way to go. I'm trying to sift from this if it's also an economically good way to go. Yes. And it's awful hard to sift that out. I know you're trying to give us good data here that makes sense. My question is, if you try comparing Oregon to like states as far as demographics concerned, the age, the number of people that are aged and people over 85 and people have a higher needs, and see how we compare to those other states that are demographically at least similar to us, what kind of programs they've had and how we've done compared to them?
Well, we can try and compile some of those data for you. Oregon tends to be near the higher end, but certainly not the highest end of the states listed here in terms of the percentage of seniors who are in the 85-plus group divided by those who are in the 65-plus group. We are at 7.9%. Alaska, by contrast, is at 4%, so they have a very young elderly population. Connecticut, which spends a lot more money than us, is at 8.2%, so they have a, on average, their elderly population is a little bit older. We can try and make some of those comparisons for you.
And it's like to get a, Madam Chair, I'd like to get a rough sense for them. My overall sense is that we have a very efficient program, but I'd like to get a better look at that.
Madam Chair. Senator
Harkin.
Dan, if I missed this, pardon me, but on page 526, when you talk about community-based care waiver clients, tell me again, how do they differ from all Medicaid long-term care clients? I understand the waivers are involved, and tell me what difference approximately the waiver makes in the cost of care and the quality of care.
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, excuse me, I realize I sprung that term on you without any real explanation, so you didn't miss it at all. we have what is called a 1915C waiver, and that refers to a section of the Social Security Act that enables that waiver to be applied for by state. What the waiver says, in essence, and I'll try and say it, I guess, as in the kind of layperson's terms that I think, and what it does is it allows us to serve clients who, under the Social Security Act, are eligible for Medicaid nursing facility care in other kinds of settings. And in every state will define the kinds of settings that they will cover under a waiver if they have one. In Oregon, the way we've defined it is we've said we will serve clients in their own homes, in adult foster homes, in residential care facilities, in assisted living facilities, and then we have certain special categories of care that have been designed for very specialized populations. For example, a head injured population in a special facility that is probably licensed as a residential care facility to provide specialized services for head injured clients. So when we talk about waivered clients, we talk about people who are eligible for the long-term care program in settings that we can pay for because we have the 1915C waiver.
Okay.
And Chair, if there are no other questions right now on performance measures, we'd like to start moving into the reduction items that were included in the governor's recommended and then the governor's revised budget. The first one of which was to eliminate long-term care services to clients in survivability priority levels 15 through 17, which the governor restored in his March 16th vision of the of his recommended budget. So in his revised budget, he, as the chair said, agreed with the co-chair's budget and restored that 15 through 17. In Project Independence, which we have on page 5-32, funding for Oregon Project Independence is restored approximately at 50% level in the governor's revised budget. And I know that you've been hearing a lot about Oregon Project Independence over the past number of months, but just for short background purposes, the Oregon Project Independence Program was in fact enacted in 1975. It provides in-home services to people who are 60 years of age and over, although people who are under 60 and have Alzheimer's disease or related disorder are also covered. They are not receiving Medicaid long-term care services.
Roger, a question on OPI, because they also pay a, some of them pay a percentage of the cost of care.
They do.
Under sliding fee scale.
They do.
And I understand that hasn't been visited in some time. But my question, one, I think it needs to be visited, and the other question is, where does the funds go that are collected for OPI?
Madam Chair, the funds go back into our budget as other funds.
Is there any way to look at those as an offset for that program?
Madam Chair, actually, the funds are collected in, and then they are actually used to provide more services in the OPI program. So
it remains within the OPI account?
Yeah, that's correct. We can try and get you data on the amount.
Give me data on that. Give me both the expenditure and the other fund offset. Will.
Be glad to, Madam Chair.
And since we're talking OPI, and I can understand the Alzheimer's and the brain injuries as a category. Was there any reason why the OPI was not set at 65 like the other Medicaid?
Madam Chair, I wasn't here in 1975, but this matches up with the Older Americans Act programs, which was in effect in 1965.
Since Older Americans Act is not funding this one, is there?
There's no, Madam Chair, there's no magic about the number. But it is statutory, and it was meant to line up again with the Older Americans Act program.
So it's statutory and state statute, not federal.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Madam Chair, also, at the time OPI was created, it was administered first by the Office of Elderly Affairs, and that was the program that also administered the Older Americans Act programs. And so setting the same age limit allowed that agency to serve that essentially a population.
Must have been some administrative simplicity going on, Madam Chair.
Pardon?
Must have been some administrative simplicity going on that by the wisdom of the legislature said that let's match them up so we wouldn't have to do more than one eligibility. You'll see, Madam Chair, when we get to the section on eligibility, that we have a number of different eligibility programs today.
I mean, you've got this chronologically advantaged population that's coming awake now.
He was rather young, 60 years old.
maybe we'll go to 55. They'll line ourselves with AARP, and they're going to go lower and go down to 50, I think. But anyway, that's another.
Madam Chair, for the record, AARP membership does start at 50.
At 50 now?
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I've been behind the.
Yeah. I've been a member for 5 years now, so.
Yeah.
Proud of him.
Representing faith.
After that conversation, I'm not sure what my question is anymore. But looking at all these programs, we're looking at kind of hydraulic models. If you drop something here, it pushes something there, and vice versa. I've never seen or been able to find, at least, what the effect of defunding OPI even by 50% will have on our other programs as far as pushing people, because they deteriorate without these programs, or potentially will, into assisted living or into an extended care facility or into other programs. Have you tried to model what that might do? I mean, if you save some money here, but what it does to other parts of your program and pushes the money in the wrong direction? Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we do not have a model. I think it is reasonable to assume that at least a small portion of OPI clients, if they lose services, will in time make their way into the Medicaid program. and you know, and you advance a theory, which I think is a good theory, that the services they're receiving through OPI helps them remain relatively functional longer. So I guess I would say that there is some very real possibility that this will, at least in a small way, speed up entrance into the Medicaid program, but we have not modeled that.
Well, follow up.
Is there at least a possibility that by cutting these programs, we in fact will ultimately increase the cost of caring for the elderly?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think the answer is, in the short run, no. In the longer run, possibly. The question is, who is going to be paying for those services? You know, as we discuss long-term services, we talk a lot about the fact that people, we have a relatively small percentage of people who we serve in the public system. That most people, in fact, are cared for by family, by friends. There are civic organizations, there are religious organizations who do, in fact, help people stay independent. And we end up serving them at a much later time. So the question of the overall cost of long-term care services, if in fact you have a number of people who get less services in with a cut like the one in OPI, some in fact will need services at a higher level in a shorter time than they ordinarily would have. And again, what numbers, what percentages, we haven't done any modeling on that.
Thank you.
What kind of information do you have that pertains to OPI that you can say this is what OPI looks like? And this is your, you know, I'm going to take Senator Yee's performance measures now.
That's yours.
what the optimum you would like to see happen at OPI. What's your goal for OPI? And if we didn't have OPI, what's your target population there for them? Give us a snapshot of what your objectives, long-term objective is for OPI.
We will do that, Madam Chair.
And while you're doing it, there should be some, and I don't know what data you collect on your Oregon Project Independence individuals, but I'm sure that that's looking at resource base.
Yes.
Where do they fall in, how many of them fall in the risk category range? Is that part of your intake eligibility information? So we could then have how many of them are in a range 13, 14, or whatever this range is, that would get us some risk factors as to what would happen if OPI didn't exist.
Madam Chair, we do in fact have, we do assess OPI clients the same way we do our Medicaid long-term care clients, any other long-term care clients. So we do know, in fact, where they fall on the survivability scale by doing that assessment. On your question of resources, there is no asset test for Oregon Project Independence. So we do, in fact, do income work because there is, as you said, Madam Chair, a sliding fee scale where people under 100% of the federal poverty level do not pay for services under OPI. And from between 100% and 200%, there is a sliding fee scale where at 200%, they are meant to be paying 100% of the cost of the services. So it's a very steep graduated scale.
If you could give us those statistics, those data that in that curve, and so that we can...
On survivability?
On survivability, and also on the percentage of those that are paying on the sliding scale and what the average payment is. That would be very helpful.
Yes, sir.
Representative Schrader.
So then at 200% of poverty level, OPI is of no cost to the taxpayer. The citizen is bearing the full cost.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, not exactly. The direct care services are at no cost to the taxpayer. What OPI also does is it pays for case management and help in arranging services, and the taxpayer does pay for those.
How much, you know, how much of that, how much is that compared to the other? The big expense?
We'll have to get you information on that that breaks out the costs of the program. The costs in the budget are the full cost, including both administrative and direct service. And each AAA essentially allocates costs within its district a little bit differently.
Are you able to estimate how many of the people currently covered by OPI would fall into a more traditional approach, i.e. levels 15 to 17, I guess, to start with, versus if they didn't get OPI, some of these people, would they just do with less at home? I mean, how much of it is helping, a convenience, if you will, versus a necessity? Is there a way to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Fitter, I wouldn't call it a convenience in the sense that one might mean a convenience is something that's not important to people. OPI clients tend, from a impairment point of view, to look a lot like in-home, Medicaid in-home clients. Mm-hmm. And so obviously there's a range from very heavily impaired to by comparative purposes, more lightly impaired. They tend to have more resources in terms of other family members, and then of course they tend to have slightly more in the way of income and assets. So we'll try and provide the information that we can on that.
And they would have to spend down to the limit of $2,000 in order to become eligible for Medicaid, right?
On Madam Chair, that's correct.
On the asset side.
On the asset side.
That's correct.
So you have to say, I'm going to spend down everything, we really have nothing left in order to get Medicaid services for OPI.
And Madam Chair, before, when Roger mentioned that he thought that the cost savings would be quite real in the short term, part of our thinking is that that in fact that asset spend down would cover costs of the program for a period of time, and we probably wouldn't see too much in the way of cost from these clients in the short term.
Senator Yee.
While we're on the subject of knowing the objective of the Oregon Project Independence, can we have the objective for the other programs of your continuum in assisted living, in adult foster care home, and in the long-term care home, so we know what's the objective of each program and understand your operations much better that way?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I will be happy to provide you information about what each of the different programs seeks to do and how they're different, if that would help in this case.
Yes.
Okay.
And also, how many people do you serve now and at what cost? I suppose this is how you arrive at this $1,532 for Oregon on page 528. You add all those costs per program and divide by the number of people you serve and get this.
Actually, we add up the costs of all the programs and we divide by all seniors in the state of Oregon.
Seniors you serve?
No, actually all seniors in the state of Oregon.
Oh, in the state of Oregon?
Yes,
sir. Not the people you serve.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Senator Yee, this is data put together by the AARP to try to look at the Medicaid expenditures compared to all seniors 65 and over. And while this is, again, it's a national measure, so I don't know if we would draw it the same way, but it's a way that, as Mr. Kaplan explained, you can, in fact, derive some information, although, as he said, there's a lot of variations among the states. So it really is sort of a test of how we're doing in terms of the amount of money that we spend. But in terms of our efficiency and how we're doing and our cost per case, earlier in our presentation last week, we talked about the amount of different costs in each of the different settings. So we've talked a lot about costs. In terms of objectives, I mean, our objective generally is, you know, to help people stay as independent and safe and healthy as possible, regardless of what setting they're in.
Oh, how about? So this is really per capita cost.
On
our population above 60.
Yes, that's right. For all, that's right. That's what your denominator is.
Mm-hmm.
All people over 65.
Mm-hmm. Right. The reason we need to know objectives is we don't expect them to stay in nursing, long-term nursing home indefinitely. We want them to get well and move on to the next continuum of care. So it'll be helpful to understand the objectives, the cost, and the people you serve. And your goals for 01 and 02.
Senator Harkin.
Yes, you know, that's really mislabeled the way that reads. Annual Medicare, Medicaid long-term care expenditures for person age 65 and older. That leads you to believe you're talking about the money that we spend on specifically. So we need to change the label.
Good point.
Yeah.
And so what is the amount that we spend on the 65 and over population that we do spend money on? You must have a figure for that, then, too. You know what your client base is, I'm sure. You know how much money is spent. So that would be a very important figure for us to know and to compare to other states, too.
In order to get, along that line, in order to get a true picture, you've included OPI, which is a non-Medicaid long-term care, in your figures on 24 and 23.
That's right, Madam Chair, because these are, I mean...
They're service.
They are, in fact, part of our Medicaid long-term care program. They're part of our community-based... Excuse me, they're not part of our Medicaid, but they're part of our community-based care program. And we'll have to... The labeling, I think Senator Hartung brought up a good point, and we'll go back and take a look at... I think your point is very well taken on 5-28, and we'll take a look at the other ones too.
Yeah, because it would imply that you actually do have, you know, when you use the term Medicaid long term, you know, OPI is not really funded through Medicaid, and so that's also on this.
You should really have labeled it per Oregonian over the age of 65.
We spend,
but also you need to differentiate between, you know, just population age 65 and that population of 65, your clients, that we actually do spend money on. Because you're not telling me that we spend money on every 65-year-old
in the
state.
I know that.
Okay, that's basically what this says in my mind.
And we will attempt to put together data on the per recipient costs, if you will.
Right, that's important.
Thank you. Continue.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I don't have anything else on OPI, except I think we have a lot of revisiting when we come back, because we'll have a lot more information which you asked for and which we'll give you. I'd like to move to the restructuring of community-based care rates and ask Mr. Kaplan to walk us through pages 5-33 and 5-34.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the governor's budget is a reduction option that is generally referred to as restructuring of community-based care rates. And the notion behind this, well, there are two notions. One is, of course, to save some money, and that is, of course, an important part of this. And this does, in fact, this proposal will, in fact, save $6.1 million of general funds. Let me come back to the the notion about what this is attempting to do from a programmatic point of view. From a programmatic point of view, we have three substitute home facility types. Those are adult foster homes, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities.
Did we just skip over 530 and just leapfrog to 533?
Are we going to 529?
Madam Chair, 530 is the survivability priority levels 15 through 17, which in fact was in the governor's revised budget. Money was restored, so I did not cover those.
Is there any information that we received that you can distinguish the population is 65 and over, and what percentage of the population is disabled? Because we've talked a lot about the elderly, but we haven't talked much about the disability population.
Madam Chair, the population over 65 that is disabled?
Well, and that's and those that are younger than 65 that are disabled.
But we certainly can supply you with information on the people who we serve who are under 65 and disabled. And we will do that.
Rent restructuring.
Within the group of substitute homes, adult foster homes, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities, we have over the years had several different rate setting systems. At present, we have a rate-setting system that pays for care in adult foster homes and residential care facilities, and another rate-setting system that pays for care in assisted living facilities. And when we look at the average impairments of the clients in these three types of facilities, they're in fact quite similar, with adult foster home care clients being very slightly the most impaired, and then residential care facility clients being the next most impaired, and assisted living facility clients being the least impaired or the third most impaired. But they are, in fact, quite close. And we end up paying widely different amounts. So if you look at the bottom of page 533, what we do is we track the average monthly service payment clients back from the beginning of 1994 and up to the present. And as you can see, there is a gap at the beginning of roughly $600 a month, and at the end, I think it's a little bit smaller than that. And what this proposal does is it takes all three of these facility types and puts them on the same rate setting system. And in the aggregate, the effect on residential care facility and adult foster home payments is very small. There will be variations from client to client. The effect on assisted living payments is significant. And in the end, and this will be phased in over over the next biennium and into the beginning of the subsequent biennium, but in the end, ALF payments will be reduced by about a third. So this is very significant from the point of view of ALF reimbursement. But what it does is it eliminates the long-standing preference in the payment systems for assisted living care and ends up paying by client need as opposed to living setting, which is something that we have been hoping to move in the direction of doing for a long time. So.
Are there any factors that would suggest that if you had a assisted living facility based on, I don't know, staffing and the arrangement of the facility, that they would suggest that they needed more than someone who had an adult foster home?
Assisted living facilities tend to be very costly, I think not so much, in comparison to the others, not so much as a result of staffing, but because of physical plant considerations. Assisted living facility units on a per-person basis are bigger. They're private. And as a result, the physical plant costs tend to be much higher. So I think that's the primary distinction.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
I understand the difference in costs because I spend a great deal of time in all three of these types of facilities on a weekly basis. What was the policy thinking of deciding to reimburse ALF higher than the other two? Was it just based on a cost basis, or was there a policy decision made concerning this? This is the part of assisted living that is growing the fastest.
Right.
Our nursing homes are flat, and I think foster and residential care are pretty flat. This is the part that's really growing the fastest, and these are nice facilities and a very high quality of life for people living in them compared to where they were before.
The facilities are very nice, and I think that's part of the reason for the expense, frankly. The thinking back at the turn of the last decade, 89-90, was that assisted living facilities would really be the part of the system that would take the place of nursing facilities. Two administrators before Roger believed that by bringing assisted living facilities into the market in large numbers, it would be possible to serve almost all Medicaid clients in community-based settings. What's happened over the past decade has not been that, and it's been that assisted living facilities, instead of taking the place of nursing facilities in the continuum of care, phrase that we also used to use a lot back then but don't as much anymore, they've taken the place They've sort of stepped in and taken the same part of the market as the adult foster home and residential care facilities. They are caring for those lighter care to mid-range care clients as opposed to the most heavily impaired. So back when the program was just being established, the thought was that rates would be set relatively high and facilities would have the ability to care for the most impaired clients. That hasn't been the way it's worked out in practice. And so after many years of looking at the way the market has shaken out, we feel fairly confident in saying that assisted living facilities are caring for the same types of folks as adult foster homes and residential care facilities, and not the same types of folks as nursing facilities, who are really genuinely caring for a more impaired and sicker clientele.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain to me how the assisted living facility rate is going to impact housing and community services? I understand that there's some intertwining of the funding, and there are some facilities that have already been built based on the current rate structure that may be impacted by the reduction.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, we have been working with housing and community services to really fully gauge the impacts and also to gauge what sort of steps can be taken by those facilities to remain financially solvent. The facilities that Representative Carlson are referring to are not owned by Housing and Community Services, but Housing and Community Services has provided loan monies to either private or nonprofit developers to build assisted living facilities and to get them off the ground. And they, like I think other people who are in this business, will certainly need to make adjustments. And those adjustments may be fairly far-ranging or in some cases not so far-ranging. And we're trying to work out all the details with Housing and Community Services now.
Let's see if I understand. The policy for expanding assisted living, and it is the fastest growing piece, was driven by the state, correct? Am I correct in this?
Representative Winters, you are correct. We created the enabling rules back about 11 years ago.
And then also, I'm going to follow up on I understand, Representative Carlson's question with respect to the development of facilities through housing and community development so that we did have facilities available. Was the state also involved in that policy?
Madam Chair, it was.
And just so now we're shifting, and we're saying that we need to change rates because we don't have those impaired clients that we thought that we were going to have, and yet these facilities that have developed in order to meet what the state policy was are facing some of them the risk of not being able to pay their mortgage. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that is a risk, and we are at this point assessing what can be done with the Housing and Community Services Department, ways that facilities will handle that. And we believe there are ways that the facilities can handle it. But it will be tough, I think, for many facilities. I mean, I don't mean to gloss this over. It'll take some very significant adjustments.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Just two more quick questions, and I'll leave you on this. First off, do you have any idea in the assisted living facilities what percentage of those people living there are actually under Medicaid? I know it's a significant number, and many of these facilities know that the sudden change in course by the state has kind of pulled the rug out from under them. They've made some long-term financial commitments to building these buildings and maintaining them. And it's happened rather quickly in the last 5 to 10 years, and now they're looking at situations where they feel they're going to lose their funding. And that goes back to not only a consideration for the state as far as having assisted in those loans, but what's going to happen to the individuals there. Have you looked? So the second question is, what's the impact going to be if those homes close, Medicaid patients have to find a place to live, and they're going to be looking at residential and foster homes, which may not be able to take the influx. Have you had a chance to look at that from a policy point of view?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the answer to your first question is roughly a third of the clients currently in assisted living facilities are Medicaid funded. With regard to the second question, I do think as a result of this proposed change in policy, there will be a shift away from assisted living care in the Medicaid program and towards residential care and foster care. And there is capacity in both those parts of the system to take a significant number of folks now, and I would expect more over time.
Representative Schrader, and then...
And might not this new policy also begin to encourage some of the some outreach from the ALFs to people currently being taken care of in the nursing facility to perhaps rethink their options a little bit? I mean, you're by altering the market a little bit, you'll have the intended or unintended effect of encouraging ALFs to have to reach out to the people that you originally were targeting them to take care of, I assume.
Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, unfortunately, I don't think that will be one of the effects of this proposal. The proposal really pulls the assisted living facilities into the same rate-setting system as adult foster homes and residential care facilities, and I think as a result of that makes it much less likely still that they will take folks who are very seriously impaired. Now, in terms of where clients get service, that will have a very small impact because the numbers of very highly impaired ALF clients are relatively few at the moment.
Representative Carlson.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to request in writing, there's been an assertion here that there are ways, quote unquote, that these people can keep these facilities going and that they believe that it will work out. I'd like to know what specifically those ways are that they're talking about and why they believe it will work out, and not just from this agency. I'd like to hear from Housing and Community Services, also their perspective on what's been being proposed to them and the impacts that they see from this policy.
You got the request?
Yes.
Senator Hartung.
Yes, Madam Chairman, thank you. Roger, whoever, I'm very interested in how these new policy changes will come about. I think I'm safe in saying that the majority of the 90 of us in both houses of the legislature are really interested in making, you know, the delivery of services, whatever, wherever it is, you know, more efficient and raising the quality of it. And so my question is, are you going to make this policy just through the regular administrative rules and policy hearings that that you're capable of doing, or are you going to involve the legislature? And the reason I say this, I think there may be some opportunities that we haven't had prior to this time for some federal assistance. I've got a lot of confidence in former Governor Tommy Thompson and now the new secretary. I know that he, Wisconsin, has struggled with the same thing that we're struggling with right here now, and I just hope that you bring in everyone that you feel has the potential of having a positive impact on what you're trying to do, and I certainly approve of what you're, applaud you for what you're doing, but I don't feel comfortable that we're looking at all of the opportunities that might be out there for us at today.
Senator, you
and I'm chair. In the department's response to our request about the impact of the reduction in rates, I want to hear a response in the rural communities where if an assisted living facility cannot survive with the reduction in rates, where would people go? Especially in the rural communities, there are very few facilities available. Maybe in the urban area, you can move them to the next continuum of care. But out in the remote areas, there is very few available facilities. And what are the people going to do? I mentioned a constituent who wrote and said his mother's 97 years old, living in assisted living facility, and with the reduction in rates, the facility does not feel they can survive, and where would they go? I mean, I'd like to hear a response.
And while you're preparing information, for me, I would also like you mention that you believe that there was the capacity in the adult foster care system. I would like to have a little more definity of what that capacity is, particularly when you're talking, you know, rural area. Do you have the pool of adult foster homes available now, and what efforts would you have to make in order to bring those up? I think we're very concerned about this particular piece.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'll make sure that we do specifically address the not only the capacity of residential care and adult foster homes to be able to take additional people, but specifically, as Senator Yee and you have also reiterated, that we make sure that we're focused also on the rural capacity.
And in responding to the impact of the issue of housing and community development,
yes,
I'm very concerned that when we set a policy that that we actually encourage the communities to do something on behalf of what the state wants, and then we abandon that policy, that troubles me, because we've asked citizens in this state, individuals, to make a huge investment, and then we turn around and we say, well, you know, sorry, you know, 5 years later, but you'll just have to suffer the consequences, and I don't think that as policymakers, you know, we can put ourselves in the position where nobody will want to do business with us. So I really hope that you really look at this particular issue and find, as you said, you felt that there were ways to to solve this problem, because it's not good public policy for us to go out and do that and then abandon individuals, because those investments are substantial.
Yes, Madam Chair.
So, just my little other words.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Are you the messengers?
Yeah.
Don't kill them.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates.
I follow up the statement. I have to leave early at 10:15 to meet with the governor. Do you want me to?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, members of the committee, actually, this is any time you make a change like this, this is not an easy change. And if it were different budget times, I'm not sure that we would be moving this quickly. There has been an issue over time in equity of treatment among the different community-based care facilities. We tried, if you'd notice, that this is a phase-in over two biennia. So the extent to which we tried to change the rates in ways that wouldn't be as drastic. We understand that you're concerned about the impact. We're going to look forward to addressing it more with you. But we also tried to mitigate the impact by spreading it over two biennia. And thank you for that question. Ian?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can draw your attention to page 535. Here we talk about another proposed change in policy. There was a bill, House Bill 2243, that would make two changes to the estates administration law. The estates administration program under both state and federal law is a program that collects monies from the estates of deceased Medicaid clients. So what happens is we file a claim in the estates of deceased clients for an amount up to the amount of medical assistance that we've provided. Our recoveries in this area reduce our dependence on general funds, so there's a financial benefit as well as us simply being required to do this. And we currently recover from the estates of all Medicaid recipients, or we at least attempt to recover from the estates of all Medicaid recipients who are over the age of 55. What the proposed changes in House Bill 2243 does is it exempts the state from a statute of limitations on filing claims, but only in the event that the client didn't fully disclose his or her assets at the time they applied for public assistance. And if you think back to what our requirements for eligibility are, an individual has to have liquid assets, in essence, of $2,000 or less. They're allowed to own a house, they're allowed to own a car, they're allowed to have personal effects. And that certainly describes most of our clients. Either they have a house and or a car and personal effects, or they don't and they have assets of under $2,000. So the vast majority of our clients are genuinely very poor. Occasionally, we run into situations where an individual has some additional property. And in cases where they disclose that property, they tell us about it, typically they would not be found eligible. So, for example, an individual owned a vacation house in addition to their primary residence. We would say to them, well, we can't make you eligible if you own this vacation house. You have to sell it, and then you have to provide your own care with the proceeds. And if you spend that money down, then you will become eligible. Sometimes people own other pieces of property. Sometimes there are financial instruments that aren't disclosed to us. It doesn't happen very much, but it does happen on occasion. And what this bill would do is it would exempt us from the statute of limitations on filing claims only in the event that there are assets in the estate that should have been disclosed but weren't. So that's the first thing it does. The second area that the proposed law will change is it will allow us to recover from the estates of individuals who are under the age of 55 or were permanently institutionalized before the age of 55. And this is really a requirement of the federal law. Federal law has changed over the last several years, and this brings us into compliance with that. Under the two parts of this bill, we estimate that this will allow us to offset an additional, well, the governor's budget anticipates that we will be able to offset an additional $1.6 million of general, because our other funds collections will go up by that amount.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before we leave the long-term care area for now, I know that we have lots of revisiting yet to do on this program, but there are just a number of items which we like to highlight for the committee that we call future concerns, because there's been a number of questions, and we presented information to you over this past number of days that talked about the demographic challenges that we have approaching us and the fact that we have done a lot over the years to try to maintain people's independence at home, or if not in community-based care. But there are certainly significant challenges, and we just highlighted four major areas that we have been working on and we continue to work on and that we want you to know about. The first is the ability to attract and retain in-home care providers. Very clearly, this is the place where people want to be. They want to be for the rest of their lives if possible. And the way that we can help them maintain themselves in that in-home environment is to have someone be able to come in and help them with their activities of daily living, as we described before. The wages that we pay for our in-home care providers have been improved over the last number of years, thanks to the legislative branch, who has in fact said yes to a number of increases. They still are not among the highest wages. We are in fact in a good economy, which makes it hard to in fact attract people even over $8 an hour that we now pay for in-home caregivers. This is not easy work. Family members do it for each other, spouses, children, but in fact, as a full-time profession, this is very, very demanding work and one which we don't pay a lot of money for people to provide care. In fact, some caregivers move from place to place caring for a number of people, and sometimes putting together enough hours in a week makes it hard to maintain, in fact, a full-time employment. So we have a lot of people doing this on a part-time basis. For some of them, it works. For some of them, they would like to get more hours. But this is a constant source of concern for us to be able to support this system, to be able to have enough caregivers to be able to support people in their own homes.
How many caregivers do we have in the state?
Well, Madam Chair, the numbers that we have really are the numbers that we have in our client employed provider program that serve Medicaid clients. Some of them are in fact serving people who aren't in the Medicaid program. Some people are paying for that caregiving privately. We know and we keep numbers on people who are in our client-employed provider system under the Medicaid program, and our last count was over 14,000. The second issue is the whole issue of reducing demand, and by that, trying to keep people as healthy and active and independent for as long as possible. Very clear, the data now that diet, nutrition, lack of using alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs certainly will add to someone's health and longevity. We have been working over time with the health division to try to be able to figure out how we can target populations, not only who are seniors, but target populations who are pre the senior time, and it would be wonderful if we had it all the way through school that people learned about the benefits of diet, nutrition, exercise, social activity, and abstinence from alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. Certainly this is a challenge for us, but one which we continue to work on. The third item, supporting family caregivers. We talked a bit about it earlier in our presentation, but the numbers are dramatic depending on which studies you happen to read, but they're anywhere between 80 and 95% of our total amount of caregiving on a long-term care basis are in fact delivered by families. We've been working with different programs, and we hope to be able to increase that work to be able to reach out to families, to help them with information, to help them to be able to get training on disease-specific issues, to be able to let them know that there is, in fact, relief care or respite care available to them, and that they can, in fact, get a break from caregiving. But in order to keep families on the job, a job that they want to do for their loved ones, they need support, and we need to find ways to be able to offer it to them.
When you say support, you're talking pretty much respite care?
Madam Chair, it's respite certainly is a big help, and I think it's probably on an individual basis it's more costly than in fact giving people information and being able to talk with them about what the practical effects of dealing with somebody who is incontinent.
If I was taking care of my parents, how would I know about your services?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, generally you'd know about our services because we are doing a great job letting you know that we're in communities throughout the state. We did, in fact, co-sponsor a program on Oregon Public Broadcasting this year that was specifically geared to the plight and the concern of families taking care of each other. We do, in fact, have developed a website called Oregon Cares, in which we are trying to provide good information for all Oregonians to be able to access, very specifically geared towards families. We have a lot more to do in this area, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, along that same line, you said we have 14,000 caregivers.
Right.
Now, who pays them? Who is their employee? The state or the various homes? Or how's that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, the 14,000 I referred to were just client-employed providers who, in fact, are part of the Medicaid long-term care system. There are others. We don't keep track and we don't keep data on people who don't serve people who are in our particular Medicaid program. But those are the people who do, in fact, serve people who are on Medicaid.
Do you have some program or policy where, and I know virtually everything that we work with in this building, involves raising salaries or wages, and I'm just thinking here, if we have 14,000 caregivers and we're 1% of the population, well, there's 1,400,000 out there around, if my decimal point's in the right place, maybe it's 14 million. But anyway, it seems to me that this has to be a national undertaking to raise, we talk about the minimum wage so much. I mean, this is more important as important as a minimum wage. And I don't think we here in Oregon, have enough leverage to even move our state dramatically, but what can we do from the federal standpoint?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, you actually hit on an issue that people are talking a lot about at the national level, and it really spans the whole long-term care system, and I think you see some very specific issues that were brought up in the Senate Select Committee on Aging, actually last session of Congress, where there was the first report of the impact of staffing on the quality of care, specifically in nursing facilities. And there's a lot of discussion about what would it take to be able to, and I hate to say it, but truly a cost benefit based on, if you put more money into staff, how much can you raise the quality? And I know that the Healthcare Financing Administration is expecting out this year another report on this, which I know that Congress is very, very interested in. But it's the workforce shortages are being discussed in the long-term care area. I know in Congress there's a lot of concern about it, especially, again, given the demographics. Senator, we're not to a point where it is, I mean, it's going to take a lot of money, candidly, to address it across the continuum. Yep. But I know there's a big spotlight on it at the national level.
Senator Hartung, 5-23.
Yes.
Is the chart that talks about client served at home. It is that client employed group there, and that you're talking about the 14,000.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's most of those people who are served in home. A huge percentage are served by client employed providers. That's correct.
Can you give us, do you have the number of hours that this group provides in service? To this targeted group that you have here listed?
We can provide that information. We don't have it in this presentation document.
But we do have it.
Yes.
We can generate it.
We will. Last but not least, Madam Chair, and probably as a segue into our next section, ensuring better care is clearly on our list of current and future concerns. We have spent a lot of time, and you'll hear about it in the next section, working with providers to provide technical assistance and training to improve their skills. We spend a lot of time and money on licensing and quality assurance in our long-term care area. And we've really been working very hard to try to move from just a quality assurance to a quality improvement program in our long-term care area. And Cindy Hannon will be up hopefully shortly to talk about that. We also, though, are very aware of our need, and I wish Representative Bates were here, but our need to work more closely with the medical community.
I have a question, because I think it's a laudable goal to ensure better care. And we've listened earlier about the elimination of our reduction of either programs or the level of payment reimbursement, and given that climate, how then are you going to, as a policy basis, attain this particular objective of ensuring better care?
Madam Chair, I believe that we, in fact, where we spent the most time today was in the area of restructuring community-based care rates and specifically assisted living. I think that we are going to have a heightened sense of awareness about what goes on with assisted living. Not that we don't today, but in fact, if there are changes in reimbursement, that we need to make sure that we are more available to them, that we are consultative with them, that we do a lot more technical assistance with them to ensure that quality of care. Dan, you want to add to that? I saw you clutching the microphone, so I thought you were going again.
I guess if I'm struggling with how your technical assistance and training with the group who is already providing care is going to somehow improve what they do if you're taking resources away from them. Help me kind of understand this, because I'm having a difficult time understanding it.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to, if I could, ask Cindy Hannum when we're going to have a whole section on it, and maybe we won't get there today, but to talk about our move to some of the quality improvement initiatives that we've had and how that will be impacted. And I think it will make sense because it will be much more in context of all that we've been doing.
Would you also expand for me that when you provide the discussion on improving provider care, helping care providers to do their job better by providing training and technical assistance, you know, historically, when we take in and we add training and assistance to a group, that then necessitates the discussion of increased salary levels and increased wages. So I want to know, getting from point A to point B, whether or not you're planning for additional dollars someplace.
Okay, we'll be glad to address that.
Madam Chair, for the provider wages,
yes.
The turnover is just incredible.
You know, that's part of their ensuring better care, and I'm trying to see if you're going to do this. I don't want to run into the same situation that we're talking about, the assisted living and the housing and community development, when we set a policy as a state that we're going to do something, and then later we say, oops, I'm sorry, but we didn't plan for it.
You can do that.
And you want to go with budget summary? I think it's, we have, Madam Chair, we have about 10 more minutes.
You want to save your budget summary, or do you want to?
Well, we'll be happy to do either one, Madam
Chair. You can get through with your budget summaries in 10 minutes. We can go, and then we'll be into
licensing inspectors.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates had to leave, but he left me with his question, and I'll just leave with him right now.
But we may not get there. Give me
right.
So you're the messenger.
And so if I don't understand my own question, it's because it's not really my question. He said he did a rough penciling out, and that based on this budget, we spend about $14,000 per year per client. And I'm not sure if he was using the base budget or another budget. And he wanted to know how that compares with other states that have similar demographics of aging population. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson and Bates, this is very similar to Senator Hartung's question about the per recipient costs, and we will try and answer them together.
Thank you.
Dan, you want to do the summary?
Yeah. Please. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we summarized the long-term care budget on pages 538 through 540. And in the interest of time, what I would like to do is just call your attention to certain of the reductions that we haven't spoken about to this point.
Reductions.
There are several that I think should be mentioned. On page 539, there are bullets by each of the reductions. The first three we've spoken about today. The fourth is restoration of Medicare upper limit money. And I can talk about Medicare upper limit if people want to hear about that. I presume you do, because it's an element of our budget that's important. And I'll come back to that, and that may be what I start off with next time. There is a follow-up page on that. In addition, for reductions, the fifth bullet is the removal of cost of living increases for substitute homes. And this,
we can talk about that, too.
And this, in fact, gets folded in. I mean, the money is kept separate here, but as we are restructuring the community-based care rates, we have, in essence, a pot of money that is reduced by both the rate restructuring savings and then this savings as well. We've mentioned the estates administration bill, and then this next item, second item on the top of page 540, is actually an increase in rates paid to nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and residential care facilities. It's a very small increase. And it is meant to offset the Medicaid share of the costs of increased licensing fees, which is something that we will get to when we talk in the next section about licensing. So I'll come back to that there. The third item, discontinuance of the Oregon Access Project development, is an item that has a savings of $1 million of general funds. This is a data processing project that we've been working on for a number of years. And the goal here is really to bring together all of the various computer systems that are needed for working with SDSD and AAA clients onto one system. At present, we have a client assessment system, we have several payment systems, and we have an eligibility system. And in the first two phases of this project, we brought together the eligibility system and the assessment system. And the rollout of the new assessment system integrated with eligibility will occur over the last few months of this biennium and the first few of next. And we do have money to do that. The third phase, which is being discontinued here, would have been the integration of payment systems. And it's certainly our hope that this is not a discontinuance for all time, but just a pause in that development.
I'm sure.
Representative Schrader.
I assume that could probably be taken care of when DHS reorganizes, and that would be probably the rationale for maybe being able to not do that at this point in time.
That's certainly a very good rationale for pausing at this point to see where we are.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Discontinuance of non-statewide projects George spoke about in his description of the governor's budget right at the beginning. These are things like RSVP and senior mental health projects. And then there is a service and supply reduction down at the end of this of $3.0 million of general funds, and that brings together various services.
Question on your reductions and your FTEs. Are these vacant positions or are they bodies?
Well, it's a complicated question. Here is the way this works. We have several reductions. The last one described in the last bullet, the 21.42 FTE, are positions that we are eliminating as part of a special targeted reduction within the governor's budget. Those positions are vacant positions.
Okay.
I should call your attention, however, to the fact that in the essential packages laid out on page 538, the governor puts money in for a fairly significant caseload growth. And as part of that money for caseload growth, he also puts in money for additional staffing. And the what is referred here as equivalent FTE is 118 additional full-time equivalent positions. And so when we get down to the reductions later on of 21 positions, one way to look at it is an offset of those additional positions.
So, and under the other reduction, you have a 46.7.
Mm-hmm.
Is that vacant?
The 46.7 is...
Or is that all a part of the 118?
It really totals all the FTE reductions that come up through the reductions. And these are...
Is this and this? 26 and 21.42?
That's right. That's it. So... In the now restored reduction,
yeah.
In the now restored reduction to levels 15 through 17 services, there was a staff reduction that went along with that. We would have fewer clients, and as a result, we have fewer.
I guess, Dan, what I'm trying to get at is, is all the 46.76 vacant positions?
I think the simple answer is yes, so I'll stick with the simple answer.
Last question.
When
you do talk about the Medicaid upper limit payments, I assume you'll talk about the rebasing issue at that point in time.
I would be pleased to.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
If I could just go back to the simple answer. If I'm trying to understand the simple answer correctly, you would be getting additional new positions, so anything above and beyond vacant positions would be offset to positions you haven't hired yet? Is that a more complicated answer to the simple answer?
That's good restating the simple answer.
Thank you. Let's do
that again.
I had a hard time getting it.
Yeah. I missed the first time, too.
They take it away, and then they bring it back.
Yeah, okay. And don't ask why. Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's no further questions, we are adjourned until tomorrow.